tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is on Welcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight we're going to hear the soundtrack of a documentary, Urban Warrior, on the militarization of policing. It will be followed by a panel discussion that took place after a recent screening of the film in New York City. Most discussions about law and law enforcement assume that our laws serve the general welfare of the population, and law enforcement is often spoken about in terms of public safety. The passage of first the USA Patriot Act and now the creation of a Department of Homeland Security have increased questions for many citizens as to who and what are the real intended targets of these laws, which have been publicized as necessary to defend the population against terrorism in the wake of September 11, 2001. One reason for this skepticism, as we shall hear tonight, is due to the fact that the basic components of most of this legislation predates the attacks by many years, and in some cases, decades. And, as we will hear tonight, elite planners have long expected their policies to lead to a lowered standard of living for many Americans while benefiting a few greatly. They have expected popular outrage, and have for some time made an effort to put in place a system that would serve government in the event of mass rebellion. The so-called drug war was used to provide much of the justification and revenue stream for the militarization of virtually every police force in American cities with populations over 50,000. The evolving militarization of the police in America has escaped press scrutiny because the brunt of these tactics up until now, such as pre-dawn military-style assaults on drug suspects, have been largely used in poor communities. Wealthy cocaine sniffers in Beverly Hills or Scarsdale or their neighbors have not faced a barrage of concussion grenades lobbed through their living room windows. Thus, the conventional view that these tactics are intended only for people who are a danger to others has been maintained, except, of course, among populations who have been the targets of such law enforcement. If government fails to address the grievances of Americans, those aggrieved must engage in acts of protest and rebellion, and are ultimately justified in removing the government. If you disagree with this, then you disagree with the whole principle upon which the United States of America became a nation. Dissent cannot be glorious in 1776 and illegitimate in 2002 and still support the claim that the United States is a democracy with a government of, by, and for the people. A lawsuit that was filed in Washington, D.C. federal court last week brings the question of the criminalization of dissent into sharp focus. The suit charges deliberate and systematic repression of political protest by the D.C. and federal government. Public interest law firms, the Partnership for Civil Justice, and the National Lawyers Guild Mass Defense Committee are representing 22 plaintiffs who are alleging that there was an orchestrated political roundup of protesters and that mass arrests were used for intelligence gathering by the FBI on political activists. According to a press release from plaintiffs' attorneys, quote, D.C. and federal law enforcement authorities executed an illegal and unconstitutional coordinated plan to sweep the streets of political activists and place them in preventive detention, said Mara Verhaden Hilliard, attorney with the Partnership for Civil Justice and the National Lawyers Guild. On September 27th, police officers told those being rounded up that they were just following orders, stated plaintiff's counsel, Carl Messineo. This complaint sues Chief Ramsey, Mayor Williams, and every supervisor in the chain of command who is responsible for issuing and ratifying those blatantly unconstitutional orders. The suit also charges that the mass arrests were part of an intelligence gathering operation by the FBI on lawful political activity. Using the false arrests, the suit charges confinement and compulsion of identification information, including fingerprints and photographs, the D.C. police allowed the FBI to collect intelligence and identification information on the political activists and persons associating with or in the proximity of the demonstration. A story on the lawsuit in the Washington Post stated that D.C. Police Chief Charles Ramsey declined to comment on the suit. He has said in the past that he does not have, quote, any problem with the actions taken by police during the demonstrations against the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Ramsey has defended the mass arrests by citing organizers' threats to disrupt the city, an incident of vandalism at a downtown bank, and protesters blocking of streets. Please note, vandalism at a bank or blocking of streets is more important than the ability of Americans to exercise their rights to protest. Here is an account of one of the arrestees, Sally Norton, an assistant professor at the University of Rochester School of Nursing, as quoted in the Washington Post. It was dehumanizing, it was painful, and it was sort of incredible that this could happen, she said in an interview. Norton, 41, was attending a nursing conference near Pershing Park that morning. Shortly after 9 a.m., she was surrounded by police who prevented her from leaving. When we walked into the park, we walked past police officers, and no one suggested this wasn't a good place to be and we shouldn't stop here, said Norton, who was arrested with two other conference attendees. From about 3 p.m. to midnight, she said, she sat on a mat in the gym of the Southwest Police Academy that served as a processing center. She said her right wrist was handcuffed to her left ankle. Another arrestee, a D.C. lawyer, testified that she was handcuffed in the same manner as Norton for 12 hours and had to disrobe during a strip search. The lawsuit charges that plaintiffs were rounded up, taken away on buses, shackled and hogtied, and detained for up to 30 hours, many being released on the streets outside of the remote Blue Plains Police Training Center in the middle of the night with no knowledge of where they were and no access to transportation. Plaintiff's attorney, Ms. Verhaden Hilliard, said, quote, "The hallmark of a democracy is the ability of people to take to the streets, sidewalks and parkland, and express opposition to government policies without the threat of illegal arrests or government surveillance and cataloging of their lawful political activity. Our ownership and responsibility for the Constitution and Bill of Rights is collective. We are confident that people will stand in opposition to the efforts of the MPD, Justice Department, and FBI to target political speech and assembly, and that they will not remain silent and allow these brazen repressive tactics to continue and fester."
There's too many people, there's too many people, there's too many people and not enough chairs. There's too many people, I repeat, there's just too many people. So we're putting them all in a big white building, putting them all in a big white building. It used to be a factory, before that it was a farm, before that it was a church. But don't be alarmed, cause you can get everything that you get out here. Nice warm bodies and nice cold beer. Yeah, you're gonna love it in the big white building, once we shove it in the big white building. And you can bet all your friends will be there, at least the ones with dark skin or the ones with weird hair. You can shout and scream that it's just not fair, but we don't care, and there's room for you there in the big white building, in the big white building.
That was Big White Building by Andrus Jones. On to Urban Warrior. The first voice you'll hear is that of Paul Richmond, a journalist and member of the National Lawyers Guild Legal Committee from Seattle, who was featured in the film. Richmond begins by detailing his growing concerns about the militarization of policing based on what he saw when he lived in rural California 2 decades ago. We apologize for the lack of identification of the speakers you'll hear in the documentary. This is the soundtrack of a film, and we do not have the film itself. We were provided with this audio track only, as is. The information provided in it we feel is, however, intelligible and worth hearing nonetheless.
I've been in the 80s with someone who lived in Humboldt County, Northern California, a lot of the area where you had the sort of so-called war on drugs taking place. And in that I saw really just this complete out-of-control use of force that was taking place. I saw National Guard being used against a civilian population. I saw the National Guard being used against a civilian population. I saw people with AR-15s, that's fully M-16s, full automatic assault rifles doing house-to-house searches, going into people's homes, breaking up everything they owned, shooting their dogs, holding their kids at gunpoint. And it was under the guise of the war on drugs. And the thing I found was that the people who were so-called growers were actually people who were farmers, timber workers, didn't have anything left to cut, didn't have anything else that they could grow on their land. Most of them were actually kind of redneck in their political affiliation, so it was kind of an interesting twist. And when I moved north after living in Humboldt for a while, I became a reporter and video producer in Oregon, around Portland, Oregon, and discovered a couple of things that... a couple of programs, again, that kind of like shocked me in terms of the way I saw the police that were becoming something that was totally beyond the scope of what they were supposed to have been. I saw this paramilitary raid that had taken place where the police, again, utilized the National Guard, grabbed a home, went into this small, out-of-the-way block, held this entire block at gunpoint, broke into people's homes again, held people at gunpoint, fired what's become a lot more... familiar to a lot of us, the less lethal weapons at some people, found out as they began investigating the raid that the person who had been named in the warrant had moved out about a month ago, and that all that was seized was one marijuana cigarette. Sort of even sort of at a higher level when I moved to Seattle in the late 90s and got there just nearly secured for just by chance, just a few mere... maybe half a year before the WTO was selected as the site for, Seattle was selected as the site for the WTO. So I had all these skills organizing people and surveying cops and police actions and began organizing people. So helped set up the first IMC mostly to monitor cops and helped set up the National Lawyers Guild legal program to, again, watch the cops and have some sort of thing. And when I saw what was taking place, there, again, it was a circumstance where just everything had just sort of gone completely out of control and beyond the pale of what we were used to seeing. A lot of it was crystallized when my father, who was in the audience and might want to comment on this later, had been a counselor in Rikers Island, and we were speaking about it a little bit afterwards, and he said, you know, I was there, I was in Rikers Island during some of the riots, and what I'm seeing on the streets on TV now doesn't even match with what's going on now. It's just gotten that out of control. So we'll show the film now. And again, I want people to look at this as sort of as an activist tool in terms of something that we're looking at doing, getting people aware of this stuff. We're sitting on about 45 hours worth of interviews from this, looking at turning this into a series, because this is just something that I think needs to be talked about, especially in the wake of the sort of hysteria we're seeing after 9/11. And we'll get into some of that and some of the reasons we're seeing some of this stuff going out afterwards in the discussion. So I hope you enjoy the film, and thanks for coming.
Protect life and property. Detect and arrest offenders of the law. Preserve the peace, enforce the law, and prevent crime.
You make the arrests, bring them to court, be as peaceful as you can and non-judgmental. The judgment comes at the court.
A police officer who's to restore the peace by getting an alleged bad guy alive, if whenever possible, and bringing him before a magistrate.
A civilian police officer is taught from the police academy and all through his career to use the minimum force necessary to accomplish the mission. The military is trained to use overwhelming force, deadly force, to win a battle and to win wars.
Their role has historically been, and their training today still involves, using a tremendous amount of firepower to eliminate a threat.
There's a fundamental difference between police and soldiers.
And one of the transformations that we've seen take place is that a lot of the tactics, methodology of soldiering have been applied to the police.
American police departments are relying upon weapons and tactics adopted from the military to carry out many of their functions, from drug raids to crowd control. Many police officials maintain that increased threats from violent criminals require that they adopt more aggressive tactics and equip themselves with more advanced weaponry. As military tactics have spread throughout American policing, concern has grown among some observers that police are coming to rely too heavily on these types of tactical approaches. Critics contend that paramilitary tactics developed to deal with extreme circumstances are increasingly being employed in situations that do not require the use of overwhelming force. This program looks at the increasing use of military methods by civilian police and investigates the controversy surrounding the growth of tactical policing.
Traditionally, there has been a sharp and clear distinction between the military and civilian law enforcement. In part, this dates back to the founding of the country, where there was a marked distrust of a standing military on the part of the founders. As a society, we have made a choice that we don't want to be controlled by the military. We don't want to have our streets patrolled by military forces. There is a law which enshrines the distinction between the military and civilian law enforcement. It's an 1878 law called the Posse Comitatus Act. It's the law which says you can't ask the army to carry out police functions in the United States.
As in a lot of things dealing with the law, there's a law and then there's a practice. And there are laws like the Posse Comitatus Act, which presumably kept the military out of law enforcement. And that was sort of a standard. What has changed now has been the presumption that there's anything wrong with it.
What we have to recognize is that, for instance, in 1995, the Justice Department entered into an agreement with the Department of Defense called Technology Transfer Amendments. And basically what that legalized the process wherein military technology would be transferred for use by law enforcement.
In the early 1980s, the Reagan administration decided to enlist the military in what has been called the drug war.
And that comes in a lot of different forms. I mean, you have the National Guard involved in marijuana eradication exercises, for instance. You have the military training civilian police forces in certain kinds of military tactics.
You began to see military-type vehicles coming into police departments. You began to see joint training exercises. You began to see the National Guard joining the police on drug raids with their spotlights, you know, shining on people's houses.
The police are obsessed with the military culture. They love the notion of hardware and military and salute and uniforms. But in fact, it's not a military operation at all. It's an individual entrepreneurial enterprise where you send one cop out there to do a job. But with the growth of rioting and disorders in the major cities of America, Newark, Detroit, burning, pillaging, looting, rioting, the police developed tactical patrol forces. So they started training police in mass formations, in squadrons, taking control of the avenues, putting down rebellions. Also, at the same time, there were a couple of hostage situations. But we had one in Brooklyn where a bunch of guys took over a gun store and held hostages. And one of the hostages was shot on the street and lying there wounded. And the police conceived the notion of bringing an armored personnel carrier up, rescuing this person and then taking them away. And this sort of introduced everyone to the notion of using military vehicles.
Well, in 1965, everybody knows about the riots and what, and as a result of this riot, was when they set up the SWAT team.
In 1967, uprisings in the urban centers took place in well over 100 cities in the course of 1967 alone. At the same time, the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration was set up. They, in turn, set up a three-year project known as the California Specialized Training Institute. The California Specialized Training Institute was set up and run by Louis Giuffrida from Army Combat Command to deal with this civil disorder in the cities. He was responsible, and those who were involved in the Institute, for the creation of the special weapons and tactics concept, or the SWAT concept.
It's, I think, an important phenomenon to understand what it means when we say militarizing the police. It may sound like an inflammatory term, but it's really not. It's an accurate term. The military model is providing a whole range of ideas, tactics, ideology, culture to the police, which a component of the police are adopting.
All right, to review what we know at this point, we have 30, potentially 40.
What we call commonly a SWAT team, a more accurate term would be a police paramilitary unit. It's really a more accurate descriptor for these teams, because these teams differ significantly from what we think of as normal policing. Normal policing generally is the cop on the beat. You know, you have the individual police officer patrolling in a car, maybe with one other officer, but in most police departments, only a single officer. And they're reacting to situations, calls for services. With this paramilitary police model, you have a team or a squad of officers that operate much like a Navy SEAL Special Forces team. In fact, the whole SWAT community considers themselves sort of the special operations forces of the police institution. And so they form in squads, anywhere from 8 to 25 members, and they go out on deployments, hostage situations, barricaded suspects, those things that really do require a specially trained team to go in and do something about them.
I used very aggressive techniques and created tactical teams, SWAT teams. There were really two ideas behind the SWAT teams. One, containment. I wanted a situation contained, surrounded, making sure, let's say, a hostage situation. I want containment. And then I want negotiation. I want endless negotiation. And just to negotiate endlessly, as long as nothing terrible is happening, understanding that we'd have to use force. And that force would involve the use of sophisticated weaponry, shotguns, heavy firearm weapons, armored personnel carriers, but as a last resource. So it's containment and negotiation.
A SWAT team on a police department, they're supposed to go in and try to negotiate hostage situations and unusual situations where somebody might be barricaded in a business or a bank or something of that nature. But to keep these SWAT teams sharp and aggressive, they are taking over more and more of these functions that traditionally are the functions of either uniformed squad car patrolmen or detective bureaus on police departments.
As we roll the videotape, you can see that the Colorado Springs Police Department SWAT team a few minutes ago entered that motel.
One of the more important findings in the research I did was that the SWAT function has changed dramatically over the last 10 to 15 years. SWAT was originally designed to handle those rare reactive situations, dangerous situations already in existence. But over the last decade and a half, those kinds of activities have really taken a back seat to basically fighting the drug war. And this, I would call this, instead of a reactive function, they shifted into a proactive function. My research shows that 80% of their deployments now are for drug raids. And most of these drug raids are no-knock warrants, where they go to a residence, they either don't knock at all, or they knock very quickly and enter the residence. They do what's called a forced entry, and they raid the home looking for contraband. It's a highly dangerous way to do police work, but it's become commonplace. SWAT team will show up usually in the pre-dawn hours of the day, usually when people are in the middle of rapid eye movement sleep. They do this so they can surprise the people, catch them in bed, generally 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, sometimes 3 o'clock in the morning. If they think the situation might be particularly dangerous, they might use a flashbang, detonation device.
You pull the spoon, you pull the pin. Lots of flash and lots of noise. They'd make people's ears ring, they'd startle them, and it gives you an extra second during that confusion to take advantage of when you make one of these dynamic entries into a room. There's sort of a standard scenario for a room entry, the type of room entry that we used to teach. It's a pretty standard thing is to set up a breaching charge, usually made out of something called inner shape charge or jet axe. It's a commercial explosive. It's initiated by either a non-electric or electrical initiating device while a team lays up against the wall or around the corner or someplace near the actual breaching point. They would pop the breaching charge and immediately go in.
Police!
entry, they will employ some very basic close quarter battle tactics. And during that entry, they're all of them picking sectors based on their plan. Each person has a sector. It's a moving sector that moves with them. And in that sector, they identify, discriminate, and eliminate targets. The discrimination of targets is based on hands. When you go into a room, you look at hands. Whatever the threat is, it's going to be in their hands. And so that's the way you do that instant target discrimination, is you go straight in, look at hands. If there's a weapon in the hands during a dynamic entry, it does not matter what that weapon is doing. It's not the old deadly force criteria, you know, TOM, that they used to, threat, opportunity, and means, that the police train for the deadly force training. If the weapon's in the hands during a dynamic entry, that person dies. It's just automatic. It's automatic on a dynamic entry. Weapon in the hand, two rounds, center of mass, and keep on going.
One of the problems of the sudden attack of a SWAT team is that people don't know that these are police. They don't look like police. Now, sometimes they even do have face masks on, but in any case, there's no badge. There's no identification that says Officer Francis O'Malley. If you get to see their back, which you're not likely to, it may say BATF, or it may say San Diego SWAT, or just SWAT. But when they're coming at you, you don't see anything except black, if you see anything at all. There was a man in Denver, but it's happened in many different jurisdictions. Wrong address, but the guy gets killed because he reaches for a gun thinking his home is under attack, and he's dead. Sorry. That's the problem when you play war in a civilian environment.
I think that the police are right to organize themselves in the most effective legal manner that they can, whatever that may be. But in the process, the police abused the uses of this new weapon very often. I think a classic case is Waco.
In 1993, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms attempted to arrest David Koresh, the leader of the Branch Davidian religious movement.
It began with a SWAT team of Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms agents going in to execute a warrant, and four of them getting killed.
After the shootings of the federal agents, a 51-day standoff ensued. The FBI attempted to force the Davidians to surrender by using National Guard tanks to assault the buildings where members of the sect were housed. During the course of the raid, a fire started, and the church compound was rapidly consumed by flame, killing over 80 Davidians, including 22 children.
Who knows how many people died? Nobody knows. It's 80-some. When there should have been containment and negotiation.
Until the feds moved in there and surrounded that place, David Koresh was moving around freely, going into town for meetings and so forth. If they had good reason to arrest him, the local officials could have simply stopped him on the street, put a set of handcuffs on him, and that would have taken care of the problem. They could have prosecuted him in the courts in Texas. That little group wasn't going to attack Washington, D.C., or a threat to national security of the United States. So why were those people in there? That's the things that just common sense tells you have to ask.
What every chief has got to learn is that it's just go or no go. Once you loose the dogs of action, the consequences can be fearful.
Nice house.
Yeah.
You know. And they tore all this apart?
Richard Brown was a 73-year-old retired worker that lived in the city of Miami, lived in an apartment, and he basically lived taking care of his younger daughter. He was accused of selling drugs, and the police department obtained some type of search warrant to go in and search his apartment. He was home alone with his daughter, and the SWAT team came.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and try again. If you need help, hang up and then dial.
Police tapes indicate that Richard Brown was calling the police. There was his daughter was on the telephone calling police because he heard the noise outside and he was wondering who it was. His daughter was on the line calling police when they were breaking into his apartment, saying that he was shooting at them. So they fired over 120 shots at Richard Brown, who they accused of having a gun and accused of shooting at them.
Yeah. The window down?
Yes, sir.
All those are bullet holes?
Yes. Yeah.
The shooting was geared toward the bedroom. The bullets went all through the windows and the air conditioning and the Chester drawers and all over the place. Richard Brown was shot about 9 times, and he died as a result of those wounds that he received from those automatic weapons. After our organization met with the U.S. attorney concerning Richard Brown's shooting as well as other shootings in Miami-Dade County, they had an opportunity to go in and look at the evidence and say, hey, there's something wrong. There's something real wrong with the evidence that the police department is presenting here to try to justify killing this man. As a result of the investigation, Richard Brown did not have any gunpowder residue on his hand. Richard Brown did not fire any shots.
A federal grand jury subsequently indicted 5 Miami SWAT officers for lying to investigators about the Richard Brown shooting.
They started using these things as cops are doing now. They started using these tactics, these SWAT tactics, routinely. I mean, you know, anytime they wanted to make an arrest and there was like 0.01% of a chance that somebody was going to be armed or there were drugs involved, you know, they started using all these dynamic entry techniques.
In late 1999, 6-year-old Cuban refugee Elian Gonzalez was rescued from a capsized boat off the coast of Miami. He immediately became the focus of a custody battle between his American relatives in Miami and the Cuban government, who wanted the boy returned to his father. The U.S. Justice Department sided with the child's father, and a lengthy court battle ensued. On April 22, 2000, negotiations between the Miami relatives and the Justice Department abruptly ended when federal marshals seized the boy from his uncle's home in an early morning raid.
There's one here. They had guns pointed at us. So I stood in this door and I stood like this, please. And they were putting the guns right here. We're going to shoot. We're going to shoot you. Give me the gun, boy. Give me the gun, boy.
I never expected that the federal marshals were going to come into a family home with weapons.
We felt the raid was an overkill. We never felt that we would go from negotiations over the phone to a full military raid.
The Justice Department claimed that it needed to use proactive SWAT tactics due to the possibility of a violent response to Elian's removal.
There were guns, perhaps in the crowd, perhaps in the house. It was unclear.
These allegations are disputed by many who were in regular contact with the Gonzalez family.
Is there a situation, are there situations with that where those tactics are justified? Absolutely. No question about it. But I think one of the dangers here, and we live in a society where the founding fathers understood very, very clearly that you had to protect the people against the abuse of power by the government. To have law enforcement officers use that sort of force in situations where basically they knew or should have known that there was no real threat to the law enforcement officer, that opens the door. That's a slippery slope.
As civil disturbance situations come up, it's the SWAT teams that respond first because they're the ones that are the use of force specialists. They're the ones that can go in as a spearhead unit. And in fact, I worked with a police department that their chief of police very much saw them in that capacity. He wanted those SWAT officers to be able to respond to those kinds of civil disturbance situations rapidly and aggressively.
The current use of SWAT teams to police protests and civil disturbances has its roots in the 1960s, when Louis Giuffrida began training police in civil disturbance management techniques at the California Specialized Training Institute.
Ever since the days of Giuffrida and his course on civil disturbance management, the techniques and the logistics of how to do this, how to deal with this issue, has proliferated.
They said, you have 15 minutes to get out of here. And like 5 minutes later, without any other warning, started shooting the tear gas and everything else. I know there were rubber bullets because I got one.
One of the most interesting developments technologically in recent years has been the emphasis is being placed on what they call non-lethal munitions. And again, for urban operations, this is very, very important.
Non-lethal or less lethal weapons have existed in various forms for the past 3 decades. In recent years, however, the development and proliferation of these weapons has increased, as less lethal technologies developed by the military have found applications in law enforcement.
There has been a transfer of leftover hardware, military hardware, but there's also been a transfer of something that's called non-lethal weaponry. Non-lethal weapons are a field of technology that have been pursued by the Defense Department, particularly over the last decade, and particularly in support of its peacekeeping mission. It refers to weapons whose principal purpose is not to kill, but to immobilize personnel and enemy equipment.
Less lethal weapons used by SWAT and tactical teams for crowd and demonstration control include newer technologies, such as impact projectiles and concussion grenades, as well as older military-grade agents, such as CS and CN gas, which were used in combat operations during the Vietnam War.
As happened in numerous cities across the country, in Washington, D.C., in Philadelphia, and various places in which protests were taking place during the last 2 and 3 years, the approach has been pretty similar, namely the use of non-lethal weapons, so-called non-lethal weapons, CS, CN gas, bean bags, rubber balls, rubber bullets. So what we saw in Seattle were all of these elements coming together.
In 1999, thousands of protesters gathered in the streets of Seattle to protest the World Trade Organization. On the opening day of the WTO talks, protesters began blockading the Washington State Convention Center, as well as the nearby Paramount Theater and Key Street intersection.
The blockades were designed to try and deny access by WTO delegates and government officials to the opening ceremony of the World Trade Organization talks.
The Seattle police concentrated their manpower at the convention center, where officers were stationed to protect the entrances. Over the course of the morning, the hundreds of protesters taking part in the street blockade were joined by thousands of additional marchers and onlookers, effectively gridlocking downtown Seattle. As the crowds grew in size, the police made an attempt to clear key intersections by using armored vehicles and less lethal weapons.
We have brought with us today non-lethal weapons. I don't want to complicate this news.
Repeatedly during the WTO, even from the police chief, we heard these weapons referred to as non-lethal weapons. The term that's used by the manufacturers is actually less lethal, meaning that they're less likely to kill. they're very narrow parameters around which these weapons can be used safely. They couldn't be shot at certain distances. They couldn't be shot into specific parts of the body. And yet they seem to have been violated in every way.
Well, I saw physical injuries on the street from rubber bullets and people going into shock. One man had a rubber bullet in his chin. Another man had two rubber bullets in his thigh.
I also witnessed a young man get hit right in the face with a canister of tear gas. They weren't just lobbing them over on the sidewalk. Those things were coming at just breakneck speed, and this hit him just right in the face. He looked like he'd been boiled alive.
In the meantime, we had Madeleine Albright unable to get out of her hotel. A number of the delegates, again, unable to get out of their hotels, or once they got out of their hotels, unable to get into the convention center or get into the Sheraton or into the Paramount Theater. And it became pretty clear by early afternoon that at very best, the WTO's opening ceremonies were not going to be able to be held. Something else that had happened while all of this was going on was that the property damage had started.
By mid-morning, a contingent of anarchist protesters started to move throughout downtown Seattle, smashing the windows of corporate chain stores.
They went through in a couple of passes to specifically targeted corporate businesses in downtown Seattle and broke windows, sprayed graffiti, and so forth. Basically without interference from the police. The police have been standing back in the areas around the convention center, and most of this damage occurred in areas several blocks away from the convention center.
While the city administration saw the downtown vandalism as justification for the tactics employed by the police, many observers noted that police actions were directed primarily against the nonviolent demonstrators blocking intersections, rather than at the vandals, who were largely ignored by law enforcement.
One of the most important things to keep in mind when you're talking about police activity in any kind of civil disturbance or demonstration or any type of police activity, really, is that the police response needs to be proportionate to the threat, proportionate to the situation.
What you do is you have a large number of people with very, very legitimate civil disobedience, and you have a small minority who are going to be burning or breaking. You have to make a distinction and target those individuals for arrest. And what has happened is there is the mistake of treating all of the demonstrators equally.
We will be exploring during the rest of the day what we ought to be doing in terms of the evening curfew tonight and its exact dimensions.
In response to the activity occurring in the streets, Seattle Mayor Paul Schell called in police reinforcements from other jurisdictions, and Governor Gary Locke activated the National Guard.
Now, I was not privy to the conversations that were happening between the mayor of Seattle, the governor, and the National Guard, and any federal authorities. I wasn't privy to that. I understood that it was happening. There were lots of conversations, and the rumors were that the city was getting a lot of pressure to tighten up the situation prior to the president's arrival.
The city was under pretty heavy pressure to kind of gain control of the situation, or they were going to not allow President Clinton to come in. So what happens is the mayor various police officials and the governor meet in early afternoon, and the mayor decides to issue a state of emergency proclamation.
So what wound up happening was that Mayor Schell, in declaring a state of civil emergency, which is essentially one step short of martial law, set out for Wednesday and for the rest of the week what he called a no-protest zone.
The no-protest perimeter was patrolled by state and local police, as well as by National Guard soldiers. Protesters were either stopped at checkpoints and prevented from entering the downtown core, or were swept up in mass arrests. Those who were not arrested were driven out of downtown by platoons of riot police.
The police strategy was to take the several hundred demonstrators that were left in the streets and pushed them out of that area, pushed them into the area, up the hill, past the Paramount Theater, and toward a residential and small business neighborhood called Capitol Hill.
I wasn't pushed up Capitol Hill. I was up Capitol Hill and observed the police sweeping up the street in phalanx, just, you know, coming up the hill. There was so much gas released that I couldn't stand on my front lawn. I couldn't, like, go outside my lawn and just go outside my front door and stand on the lawn and breathe.
My wife and I heard on the radio that the police were randomly shooting people with rubber bullets coming out of the QFC on Capitol Hill. And during this period of time, the reporter was also getting hit, and she was literally crying on the air and as she was trying to get out of the scene. So my wife and I went right there.
What you find is that the police were up on Capitol Hill largely for no reason, without any clear orders about what they were doing or what they were trying to accomplish. And essentially what they were doing were inflaming the residents to come out to what was happening and protest the police activity, which I think anybody would rightly do.
Immediately I knew something was happening. I heard the sound of helicopters. I could see them flying in the sky a couple blocks away from where I live. So immediately, I chose to pick up my video camera and then go out to see what was going on. They didn't look like the crowds during the actual protest, during the downtown activities. So it was, I could easily tell that there were just people who lived in the neighborhood. A King County Council member by the name of Brian Tadowski was there that evening. The whole time, he was trying to constantly go back and forth between the crowds and the police to sort of negotiate some kind of agreement or some kind of truce between the two sides.
I want to know why all these police are here.
I agree. The reason they're here is... I felt that the first bit of action that should occur is that we should get the demonstrators on the sidewalks, get them out of the street so that the police would not have a pretense to do this. And so we did that. It took a couple, 3 hours. And slowly the pressure was diffusing and it was getting less and less of a concern. By now, this crowd of 1,000 had diffused itself to maybe 100 or less, and they were singing Christmas carols. And I was quite pleased because after 4 and 5 hours of a real tense standoff situation, it had wound down to Christmas carols. And, you know, I turned my back on the police line. And no sooner did I turn my back on the police line than I was hit in the back with a tear gas canister.
The militarization of the United States plan as to how to handle these protests was in place long before thousands of people hit the streets of Seattle.
Press reports filed by CNN confirmed the presence of active duty military personnel at the WTO event. Reports filed by the Seattle Weekly also noted the participation of the Army's Delta Force team in operational planning.
What we discovered was that the Delta Force, at minimum, was that they were in a motel very close to the action in downtown Seattle with video cameras and personnel out among the protesters, literally sending back camera feeds to a motel surveillance center and decision-making center. They were planning to use the Delta Force apparently quite routinely to monitor the demonstrations and participate in the decision making as to how the meetings and the delegates would be protected during the course of the ministerial talks.
It's important to understand that there's not just a process of the military bleeding into the police. It's not just the militarization of the police that's going on. It's the policification of the military.
Despite the Posse Comitatus Act, active duty military personnel have increasingly made inroads into domestic law enforcement operations, including the FBI raid at Waco, Texas. During the course of the 1990s, the military was also active in border patrol and drug interdiction efforts.
And so we have got the result of a war against drugs that has increasingly been used to water down by law the barrier that had been drawn up by the Posse Comitatus law, so that the military is no longer more than arm's length from civilian law enforcement. The military is increasingly able to intrude into the war on drugs. And as a result, not surprisingly, since the military function is not compatible with the Bill of Rights, the Bill of Rights has suffered.
So, you know, Posse Comitatus, which has been around since, I think, 1873, is gone the way of, like, the Glass-Steagall Act. They didn't have to repeal it. They just sort of went around it until it was meaningless.
The events of September 11 came as a shock to everybody, and their implications will be sorted out for years to come. What it means is that our organizational structures of national security have suddenly become very fluid. One of the things that is up for grabs is what should be the role of the military in civilian defense, including civilian law enforcement? Should we increase the military presence on our borders? Should we have military personnel at the airports?
There are still plenty of people in the military that believe strongly that these kinds of homeland security measures are more appropriate for civilian police forces. They would argue we should bolster federal law enforcement. We should take local law enforcement and better coordinate it. We have adequate police forces, in other words, to handle the internal security of this country. Because the military has been drug into various internal security roles for a long time now, this 9/11 incident